Good afternoon. I want to thank Margaret and Neil for organizing this and inviting us. It's an honor to be here. It's been a privilege and an honor. I want to thank Peter for being himself for 80 years and carrying on and with the struggle. I want to hope that I'm seeing a lot of blood sugar moments going on out in the audience. So if you're really falling asleep, try not to lay your head on your neighbor. But if you can go out and get some air, that'd be good. I want to start off by talking a little bit about the right to the city. And then I want to dig into what I know best, which is the Tenants and Workers United and our work in Virginia to sort of illustrate some of the points of our approach and our collective approach to organizing. So first, let me see if I can get this PowerPoint thing up. Thanks. Let's go to the next. Can I just go to the next slide? Next slide. Okay. There you go. Okay. So the Right to City Alliance was co-founded by Gihan over here, Gilda Haas from the Los Angeles group called SAGE, Strategic Alliance for Just Economy, and myself from Tenants and Workers United. We had our founding convention or Congress convening in Los Angeles in January of 2007. That reflected about 2 years of the three of us working in small group trying to figure out what the hell we were going to do. At this point, we have representation from about 50 community-based organizations grouped into eight sort of regional city areas. Los Angeles, which has, I think, seven or eight groups. I might be wrong. Jackie can correct me here. But SAGE, Kiwak, which is a Korean Immigrant Workers Alliance, SAN, South Asian Network, Union de Vecinos, Union of Neighbors, and several other groups are from Los Angeles. Most of the groups in Los Angeles are working around gentrification issues and the struggle for housing and land. In the Bay Area, we have another seven or eight groups, Just Cause Oakland in Oakland, Poder and Power, two separate groups in San Francisco. Again, they've been fighting around gentrification in both the African-American and immigrant communities. In Boston, we have City Life, Vida Urbana, DARE, and several other groups. City Life has been sort of out on the front lines right now, and actually it's interesting. I saw the Deutsche Bank thing around here is they've been dealing with foreclosures in Boston and doing blockades of the foreclosures, and actually one of the banks they're focusing on is – or one of the foreclosees or foreclosers they're focusing on is Deutsche Bank, which owns a disproportionate amount of the homes that are being foreclosed in Boston. New York is probably our strongest region. There's well over 20 organizations there. Make the Road New York, Fierce, which is a gay, lesbian, transgender organization, CAV, which is an Asian organization, Picture the Homeless, which, as it describes, is a homeless organization. And they've been meeting regularly for the 2 years and are working towards developing an urban platform, a municipal platform, heading into next year's municipal elections in New York City. In Washington, D.C., there's just two organizations, one D.C. and Washington, Tenants and Workers United in Northern Virginia. Miami has Miami Worker Centers, Powder U, and several other organizations. And Chicago has seven or eight groups that are in the process of becoming affiliated with Right to the City. Oh, missing one there. And New Orleans. Actually, one of the central groups of our central areas of all of our work is New Orleans. We have Safe Streets and FLIC for Family and Love of the Incarcerated. Family and Loves of the Incarcerated. They're not actually housing groups. They're dealing with the post-Katrina ravages of public education, of public housing, and particularly incarceration. The incarceration rates throughout the United States, but particularly in New Orleans, are unprecedented. So both Safe Streets and FLIC are dealing with that. So what I want to now do is dig into, and I'll be using the chalkboard in my sort of decidedly low-tech way, to talk about Tenants and Workers United as an example of the work of groups within Right to the City. So first, I want to start about sort of our early history, and we're somewhat older, longer lived than some of the partner organizations within Right to the City. We've been around. We just celebrated our 22nd anniversary, so we started in the mid 1980s. Survey question: Virginia, do y'all know where that is? An idea. So here, we'll do the first thing is a map. We got any cartographers here? Okay, this is Virginia. There's Washington, D.C., Northern Virginia is roughly 2.5 million people living in there. So now we know. So through its history, so Virginia was a slave state. Virginia was one of the original 13 colonies. Virginia was a home to Nat Turner and some slave rebellions. Virginia was also a state where public schools were shut down rather than integrate, not less than 30 years ago. And now Virginia is a state, and this is where sort of the composition of the working class has been changing, where there's been massive immigration over the last 20 years. Slide number two. That's why I stick with the chalk if I can help it. Go to those other, that other, the maps. Oh, this is creating sort of a get smart effect. Okay. Thank you. That's great. Yep, we're good. Thanks. So I want to just show the sort of changing population mapped out in the Metro DC area over the last, really, 30 years. So 1970, you can see up there, that's the D.C. metro area. D.C.'s in the very center. I don't know the exact numbers, but that's where Latino immigrants lived, a little cluster in Washington. It was relatively small, certainly less than 50,000 people. A little later, 10 years later, that's how they do censuses. So starting to grow. This is like that SARS conversation we had the other day. So starting to grow, there's populations expanding out into the suburbs, Alexandria, which would be the stuff to the south of the river, if you will. Other suburban growth there. Oh, you got it. Oh, okay. Oh, even better. Even better. Yeah. So there you can see that. So that's 1980. There's starting to be immigration. And so how does this relate to the right to the city stuff and globalization? So there happened to be a war in El Salvador that the United States was funding and sort of operating for a number of years. That was one of the peak years around the 1980s. It started pretty much. And so right around here, you start to getting migration from El Salvador to Washington, D.C. area. And Northern Virginia is one of the sort of landing spots. As time would go on, going to 1990. You're good. Thanks. See, it's a learning experience here. There we go. So by there, you can see the massive influx. Now, census is historically undercount people of color and immigrants, particularly who have... If you're undocumented, you're probably not going to want to fill out a 30-page government questionnaire, but you can start to see the massive growth by 1990. And that's a direct reflection of U.S. of globalization and U.S. Foreign policy and intervention in El Salvador. And our organization grew in the midst of this. So we started doing our work in one particular neighborhood, Arlandria, Alexandria, which right about right in there. It was a neighborhood of 10,000 people, and again, you can go through the different years and histories of... Oops. No, I'm good for right now. I'm good for right now. We're good. We can go through the different histories of Alexandria as a southern city up until 1950 being segregated. The section where we were located was... where Arlandria is located, where our organization began, was historically a white working class neighborhood. The other side of the railroad tracks literally was an African American section of the city. It was George Washington's hometown, and hence it was a slave and tobacco, both port and center. It wasn't until really the 1970s that racial segregation started breaking down, and actually African Americans started moving to the Arlandria neighborhood. Right around that time, this again sort of ties in with federal investments, There's a $40 million flood control project put in around a local creek that periodically flooded. And all of a sudden, the land, which, as you can see, is relatively centrally located, became extremely valuable. There was no longer flooding happening every 2 or 3 years. And at that point, this is by the 1980s, the city, again, despite the idea of the free market and all, the city is really priming the pump and offering incentives for developers to come in and move out a huge 10,000 population of low-income working-class folks, African-American and Latino. At that point, we started our organization. Actually, it was in 1985 when 3,000 residents came to their homes and saw a note in English. Most of the residents, had, by that point, two-thirds were Spanish-speaking, saw a note on their door that said, you have 30 days to move. So as an organizer, that was probably the best poster that ever came out in terms of getting attendance at meetings. We immediately had a number of volunteers come together from inside and outside the neighborhood, and we fought for 5 years. And what does fighting mean? So it really means a lot of organizing and developing a core of leadership. So for us, organizing, it's about power, and it's about building a core of leadership. So in the end, we were all volunteers. We pulled together probably 50 or 60 people out of the neighborhood. We had a conscious understanding of what was happening and how to fight it. We had an alternative proposal calling for eminent domain, which is seizing the properties, the 3,000 apartments in the public good. We marched on City Hall, again, with African-American, Latino, white, marched on City Hall and actually seized City Hall. And in the end, the city refused to seize the property and then the public good to preserve affordable housing. But fortunately, and this is sort of similar to today, this was, I think it's called the second wave of gentrification. The economy crashed. This was like 1989, 1990, and the property owners who had bought at highly inflated prices could not increase the rents enough, could not evict the people fast enough, could not turn the properties into condominiums fast enough to make their money back, and they went into bankruptcy. This was the bank failure, the savings and loans crisis of the early 1990s. So our approach during this period was that we should see the community should seize that. Generally, it's an opportunity. Generally, when a bank fails, just like it's happening now, it's the same sort of rich capitalist class that takes advantage of the moment and rebuys these properties. Our perspective was that residents who had historically lived there for, in some cases, 10 years, in other cases, 3 or 4 years, had really paid for the buildings and had a right, we didn't call it at the time, but it was a right to the city, a right to stay. And we organized, there was a bank bailout agency, and 10 years later, that was how long the process lasted, we completed a cooperative conversion in which the residents collectively controlled their resources. They collectively owned 300 of the apartments as a limited equity cooperative, which maintains affordable prices for at least 99 years, I believe it is. So I want to draw a couple conclusions as in terms of, we started sort of as an ad hoc organization, and we had, over the time, developed several ideas around organizing, which I want to sort of draw out here. Uh-oh, I've got to do the blackboard again. First of all, so how do we build power? It's all about power, right? We see this as a relationship of power, race, class, gender, power. So how do we build power? We have three axes of power, which is organizing money, organizing people, and organizing ideas. So I think the first one's fairly self-explanatory. We had to, for example, in this case, buy property. Even if it was bankrupt, we had to raise $7 million. So that was organizing money in a certain sense. It wasn't our money. It was somebody else's money, but we did organize it. Organizing people is, again, I think, self-explanatory. But I sort of want to draw out. It's self-explanatory, but it means going door to door and having literally thousands of conversations. And it means bringing a cadre of leaders and having dozens of conversations, developing a clear understanding, a consciousness, and then going out and moving many other people. And lastly, the battle of ideas. So again, the idea here, during a time of free market capitalism, during a time when the idea of modernizing apartments meant replacing the people, we had to battle those ideas about the right to housing and the right to collective resident ownership. So those are the three sort of axes of power that we use as we try and build power. We have five sort of lines of struggle as we sort of run our campaigns, and I'm going to lay those out pretty quickly. So one is mobilization. That's one-on-one, that's moving the people. Number two is coalition or allies. Number three is communication. Number four is internal education, political consciousness raising and development. And then research. And research can be both participatory and sort of more formal both. So these are the sort of strands that we're running simultaneously anytime we're doing organizing in a campaign. That's what we use to create this housing cooperative. I want to go into some other examples as, again, partly in relationship to the economic cycle, and talk about how over time we are grouped with the groups called worker centers, and I would say we are working class centers, we are working class and oppressed nationality center, we are working class, oppressed nationality and women's centers, because we're not necessarily organizing workers at their job, we're organizing working people in their community. So it really comes down to around social wages, and quite often a lot of our struggles have been around social wages. So what does that mean? That means struggling for a complete reform of the public school system. There's a three-track system in the public schools. African Americans are geared or steered towards, basically it's a jail track. Latinos are kept in a English is a separate language, so when you graduate high school you're not prepared to go on to college. And then primarily white folks are prepared to go on to a four-year university. So as part of our social wage struggles, we're organizing youth and their parents around school reform. And our argument is that the demands coming from our lowest strata of the working class can actually create changes that benefit the entire school system. And we try and I'll just give a quick example on that. So we demanded at the local public school that 50% was Latino, 50% white and African American, that there be a dual language bilingual program with a modified school calendar, a school calendar that went around the U.S. schools are usually shut down for 3 months during the summer. The idea was to have a much shorter summer break and have sort of creative learning during breaks interspersed throughout the year. For two reasons. One is there's a language drop. If you're a Spanish speaker and you take 12 weeks off, you drop about 5% in your retention of English over the summer. And secondly, was to provide access to creative learning instead of test-driven learning. And we were able to basically run a campaign over a course of 2 years that eventually resulted in the creation of a dual-language full-year school. So that's one example. Similarly, in health, real quickly, healthcare in the United States, if you don't have health insurance, actually, what's the first question when if you injure yourself and you go to the hospital in the United States? Do you have health insurance, right? And so, and most of our population, actually 80% of it, has no health insurance. So we did a whole campaign demanding medical debt relief from the large nonprofit hospital chain and have won about $2 million of medical debt relief. I think we've had a number of campaigns throughout our 22 years, and those are some examples. We've also organized working people as working people in some cases, taxi drivers, childcare workers, day laborers. But I want to get real quickly to our most recent work, which really is reflective of our goal of building a historic bloc, a historically constituted group of both class, race, gender, people that we can bring together that's actually a new majority in Northern Virginia. And so we've started doing for the first time in our history electoral work. And what has happened is our members started in one neighborhood, but over 20 years people have moved out and immigrant communities have moved out throughout the region as well as African Americans and actually constitute about 45% of the Northern Virginia population. As that was going on, we were sort of stuck in one place organizing very tightly one community. It was through this most recent election that we started saying we need to reach out to those tens of thousands of people that really should have demand similar to our core base, our core membership, and we used this election to try and do it as we went out and talked to actually 42,000 people or 42,000 households about the demand, asking questions about their support of universal health care and immigration reform. And some impact was it helped to move the state of Virginia, which has, again, been very conservative, part of the South, terrible racial history, to actually support Barack Obama in this most recent election by, I think, 51 to 49%. Last piece is just why national, why right to the city? Zero. okay. So basically, we've done a lot of good work. We've organized our neighborhood extraordinarily well, but our power is very limited. There's very little that we can demand. There's a need for national. There's a need for a capacity to make demands that can actually meet the needs of our community, our members, and our people that are bigger than any one specific municipality or one specific neighborhood. So there was a search for something national, and then there was a search for folks that had similar mind worldviews, folks that had similar histories and practice, and that was sort of what constituted and led to the bringing together at a national level of the 50 organizations who constitute the Right to the City Alliance. Thanks.
That's my job. I'm sorry for interrupting you, but that's my job. Thank you very much, John. And our third and last speaker on this panel is Gian Pereira. And, yeah.
Good afternoon.